You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill Scher.
Good morning, Matt Lewis.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody. It's a balmy 50-plus degrees here outside your nation's capital, heading up maybe close to, might make it to 70. It's a nice week here.
Yesterday was pretty good for us. We're going to crack 60 today. So definitely, I mean, in New England, I feel you usually get this blast of spring in early March, and everybody gets all excited, and then you get your late March, early April snow, and everyone's shaking their fists like, I thought it was spring, and I'm just like, every year, guys, every year.
In like a lamb, out like a lion. Man shakes fist at cloud.
The bigger news in Massachusetts, man, is the state's, I forget what the person's title is, but there's like a state superintendent, education commissioner or whatever. He was given the authority to open up the schools fully, and he has now said April 5th, every elementary school must be full-time in person. April 28th, every middle school must be full-time in person. They haven't set a date for the high schools yet. So,
how confident are you? Because there's been a bait and switch in some places. Are you pretty confident this will actually happen?
I mean, I feel like, you know, the momentum is there. The demand is there. The one thing you never know, I mean, locally, our hybrid plans got pushed back once there was a local spike. When there was a cluster that occurred, people flinch and said, let's push this back a few weeks. So if we got, you know, some people are upset with Governor Baker that he's pushed the restaurant openings big when the public health official said that he shouldn't. So if that backfires on us and we got a big spike again, maybe they pull back. But
yeah, Maryland, I just saw Maryland is going to 100% capacity in restaurants, bars, and churches, which is good. So I don't know what to think about that, but I'm definitely in favor of the schools, especially elementary schools, as I've written, should have been open a long time ago. And this is good news for Bill Scher from a personal standpoint.
From a personal standpoint, putting aside all politics and controversial questions, I'll be happy that my children are not in my house most of the time during the week.
Also good news for Bill Scher, I feel like you have been pretty right about the Biden administration so far and how things have gone. Generally speaking, how are you feeling?
Well, I mean, I think that's excessively charitable right now. I mean, I didn't say anything false about the early weeks, but I think it's fair to say I was more optimistic that Biden would get 60 for the relief bill. I thought the potential was there, and maybe the potential was there. We'll never know.
I don't think you've been proven wrong. It's something that was not tried. So
right. I mean, and I did think Biden would have tried more. I thought there'd been a bit more genuine back and forth with the group of 10 that didn't happen. And I thought some of the group of 10 would try harder to say, let's get on the right side of this thing because this thing is so popular. But I never ruled out the possibility that it would go partisan, which is what happened. And the question now is, does that have a reverberation effect? Does it matter that he didn't go bipartisan on this bill? Does it make it harder for him to go bipartisan on the subsequent bills? Or are they totally separate matters? You know, what I feel about infrastructure is totally detached from how I feel about relief. You know,
I think clearly, like in, this is my interpretation, but I think clearly in 2009, some of the, you'll disagree with this, Bill, but stick with me. Some of the decisions to say things like, we won, you lost, did have consequences. However, this time around, the Republicans just don't seem to have their act together. I mean, I think that in the wake of Donald Trump, there wasn't, and you've pointed this out, there really wasn't like a coherent or organized effort to stop this big spending bill. Republicans don't really, you know, the individuals and institutions who might have stood up against this on principled grounds were either co-opted or, you know, sort of defeated by Trump and Trumpism. And so, like, I don't even know if the Republican Party and the conservative movement has the resilience to hold, like, to seek revenge against Biden for not cooperating.
Well, this is kind of the strange thing about the turn of events. There was not any coordinated pushback. There was not anything like 2009 where they were calling it the porculous, you know, right out of the box. And Obama had to kind of had to scramble and spoke very sharply about Republicans in order to maintain Democratic unity. And when it did pass, it wasn't the Recovery Act 2009 was not as popular as the Biden Rescue Plan currently is. And even with that being the case, Republicans were still unified on the vote. So they didn't do what they should have done if they were going to be in total opposition, which is make a good argument for being in opposition. Yeah. They didn't do that, but they stayed opposed anyway. So, you know, in my mind, that's not a great position to be in. You know, how do you defend yourself if the plan works well? Now, look, if we end up in a hyperinflationary economy, they can say, see, I told you so. But if
right. But I mean, you know, ideally, your goal would not be to have to lose the vote and then get to say, see, I told you so. If you actually believe that this is going to cause inflation or that there will be moral hazards or that eventual, you know, whether it's inflation or something else, that spending is going to catch up to us. Like, it would be better to actually, and you're not going to stop this bill, but maybe instead of $1.9 trillion, maybe it could have been $1.2 trillion, you know, and that might have been the difference if we're talking about inflation.
I mean, this is very much a minority view, and, you know, nobody is going to give it much credence because it's totally counterfactual alternative timeline. I think that based on things that Collins has said, that Cassidy said, that Romney said, I think there was an opening for somewhere in the realm of, you know, 1.2 to 1.5. But it's all hypothetical. I can't prove it QED. Yeah. I never will be able to.
But if that happens, then you pass – you get to say that it's bipartisan. Does that grease the skids, theoretically, for more cooperation down the line?
Well, I mean, I think there's a fair argument that, you know, the vote on one bill doesn't automatically preclude in the vote on a totally different bill. If the dynamics exist for bipartisanship on some other issue, if there's something for the minority party to get, they will still want to get it. However, the fact that Republicans stayed this unified without having any rhetorical infrastructure to buttress it does speak to the levels of polarization and mistrust that occur here. So I do think that we need some kind of ice break moment to get past the polarization and mistrust. And what's happening now instead? I mean, the issue that is getting the most attention, I'd say, is HR1, the voting rights issue. And, you know, I've argued that you could sell this bill in a way that would engender bipartisanship. You could be making the case, hey, Republicans, this isn't out to screw you. Look at the data. Look at the demographics of the non-voter pool. Look how well you did in Florida in-person vote, early in-person vote. Look how you did in mail elections in certain states and districts. Look at the felon numbers that are mostly white non-college. There's reason for you to get behind a lot of the elements of this bill. Let's talk. Instead, Democrats are saying full bore, Republicans are out to suppress the vote. This is to stop that from happening. I have no expectation that they're ever going to vote for this because they think it's not in their interest. And Republicans are saying this is a giant power grab on the part of Democrats. This is National Review's had a whole screed about how this is one of the worst bills of all time. And Sheldon Whitehouse, a senator from Rhode Island, has said flat out that the strategy is to put it on the Senate floor repeatedly, you know, bring on the filibusters, show that Republicans are unreasonable here about something as fundamental as basic democracy, and use that to get Manchin and Sinema to move on the filibuster question. So no one's even thinking about how to break the ice or thinking about how to break the filibuster. So it's hard to now think where so that's more likely to bipartisanship, which is infrastructure. Infrastructure has some inherent bipartisan appeal because you can get back some money for your state or district and say you built this project. But it does hit tax questions. It does hit climate, environmental questions, which are very polarizing. And you have Democrats in general saying, we don't trust Republicans. They're out to screw us, and we're out to screw them. That doesn't bring much of a dynamic where you're going to find some meeting of the mind. So I'm certainly pessimistic about where things go from here in terms of bipartisanship.
Right. I mean, so just back to H.R. 1, I mean, first of all, you know, very clearly, you know, Democrats have decided to make Republicans cannot be persuaded or dealt with. They need to be broken. The Republican Party needs to be broken, and that's going to strategically guide their how they play this going forward. The problem I have with that is, you know, these are huge bills with a whole bunch of stuff in them. Like, I don't think that should have been a $1.9 trillion bill. Like, I'm just speaking, you know, not as someone who wants to kill it, but just it was big, and there were a lot of things in it that probably shouldn't have been in it, right? And with H.R. 1, I think you could be someone who generally agrees with reforming, but Democrats are taking this apocalyptic view, like if we don't pass this bill, we'll never win another election again, and it's the end of democracy, and Republicans are out to destroy democracy. And I'm sorry. Look, I thought it was fine to do mail-in voting during a pandemic, but generally speaking, I think people should vote in person when possible. And the idea that you should just be able to show up on election day and register, and if you think that's not great, if you oppose that, or if you just think that's not the best way to go about it, you're somehow like a racist who's out to stop democracy. Like, that excludes, you know, a lot of normal conservative people who just happen to disagree on one of the many things that they're throwing into this bill that they're claiming is vital for democracy.
Right. I mean, there are philosophical differences about a lot of these points that I think you could work through and have some give and take on both ends if everyone in the room is agreeing the point of this bill is not to help one party screw the other. Now, I mean, when I wrote my piece, I wrote about this in the Washington Monthly a few weeks ago, some people thought I was being unfair to Democrats for suggesting their interest was selfish and not primarily moral. And I'm not arguing that Democrats are primarily selfish here, but the fact remained just a few days ago, Jim Clyburn, you know, House leadership, Democratic leadership, was asked about Manchin and Sinema's resistance to the filibuster and on this question. And he said, if they like being in the majority, he'll abolish the filibuster and pass H.R. 1. I mean, that's not a verbatim quote. But he did say if they want to be in the majority. So, you know, they keep putting it out there that that's part of the mix of their thinking. And so obviously that's going to put Republicans, you know, that's going to get their backup. And they just don't have to do that because it's not even true that it is going to help them keep their majority. So that's what sort of drives me insane here is I don't think the numbers back that up.
And there continues to be reporting. I just read something the other day that talked about how a disproportionate of you know, convicted felons are minorities or something like that. And it's like, well, okay, that is true, but a disproportionate number doesn't equate to a majority necessarily. But it seems like the shorthand on this is different than reality.
Can I give you just one fun anecdote? I didn't get to put this in my article, but I think it's fascinating. Do you know the most dramatic example of same-day registration impacting an election?
I'm going to guess it's a Republican, Bill.
It's not a Republican, but it's not a Democrat.
Ron Paul?
Jesse Ventura.
Ah, yeah.
1998 Minnesota gubernatorial election, 70% of his vote was same-day registrants.
Okay, so in my opinion, that is once again an argument against same-day registration.
I mean, you could do it either way. I mean, Jesse Ventura was not the worst governor. I mean, he was. It's like Minnesota fell apart on his watch. He got light rail done. Light rail was good. I mean, his biggest thing, he went off half-cocked at having a unicameral legislature, and it didn't happen, you know.
My biggest problem with Jesse Ventura is not even about Jesse Ventura. It's about that I think he was he ushered in Donald Trump. So, you know, and it was a forerunner.
Well, there are some lines to draw there. He brought in a lot of unlikely and previously non-voters, predominantly young white males. And that's not a pool of people that is owned lock, stock, and barrel by either party. So why would you assume that in HR1 that if you do this, that one party's going to automatically benefit? I mean, it could lead to a host of weird outcomes that you can't control.
No, I completely agree. You could imagine that if Donald Trump ran again, he might ironically benefit from some of these very
absolutely charismatic celebrity. Speaking a language that appeals to people who are skeptical and cynical about the system, that's the kind of person that can take advantage of a same-day registration law.
So what I'm against, I'm against same-day registration. It's sort of like I don't want there to be a barrier that's insurmountable. What I want is premeditated voting, first-degree voting. Like, voting shouldn't be like you come home and you find your wife in bed with another man, but there happens to be a shotgun there and you pick it up and shoot him. Like, that's the passion catching up with you. You do crazy things. This should be Tuesday's election day. I'm going to have to make some plans to vote either before work or after work. It's not insurmountable. In fact, we could even move it to a weekend. That's a reform I would totally be fine with. Or make it a holiday, whatever. But I like physically going to vote, if possible, if there's not a pandemic. And I like a little bit of, I had to plan ahead a little bit. Like, it shouldn't be insurmountable, but
you don't want
a
to be,
little
you,
bit.
You don't want an impulse buy.
No, that's what I want. Now, does that make me a bad person? Am I trying to what's the term of art? Am I trying to disenfranchise voters because I want them to actually plan ahead a little? Some people would say yes. But if you can't get, you know, if you can't get like Mitt Romney or, you know, like a Liz Cheney or a Mitt Romney or, you know, if you can't get like normal Republicans for anything on your agenda, it makes me question, like, if this is a good idea.
Well, but I think I said this in the last show, so I don't want to dwell on it, but I do think a lot of the vote suppression tactics being tried by Republicans at the state level is racist in intent. They are trying to suppress black voters and younger voters who lean left. I don't think it's working as they think it's going to work, but that is their. But Democrats see that. They say, I see what you're doing. I see you in Georgia saying that if you're under 65, you can't use mail. If you're over 65, you can. And guess what? Those are the people who are more likely to vote Republican. I see what you're trying to do here. I think that is what they're trying to do. It doesn't mean that's going to work as intended because people can adapt to voting regulations. I mean, that's what happened with voter ID. It's intended to suppress that vote, but people get pissed off voter rights organizations kick into gear. They make sure people know what to do to still vote, and then they have.
And you could also end up turning out again disaffected working class white voters who normally don't vote. You know what I mean?
Well, there's all sorts of unintended consequences to these things, and if you could put all that aside, maybe you actually can find a compromise bill. But I'm not expecting that at all at this point. Now, the other interesting thing about this dynamic is, you know, HR 1 is definitely moving up in priority for Democrats, but not because Biden has given a signal to do that. It's more bottom up from the rank and file of the party. And just something else I wrote about in Washington Monthly early this week, you know, we're already in mid-March. Typically, in the first year of a presidency, the new president gives a address to a joint session of Congress. It's technically not State of the Union, but it's often perceived that way. And in that first speech, the president lays out the priorities. What are the top things on my agenda? And these don't always neatly track what was said in the campaign. Usually, at this point, it's getting down to brass tacks. Okay, these are really the big three, the big four, the big five. There'll be a lot of I ask Congress to do, which is the signal I really want legislation on this front. I'm not just going to do this myself through executive action. And these things have an effect on what happens legislatively. When Obama said in 2009 that his top things were climate and health care and education and financial industry reform, and he didn't say anything about gun control or immigration, guess what? Gun control and immigration were not the big things in his first term. They ended up being bigger in his second term. So the signals affect behavior on the rest of the party, but Biden hasn't done that yet. I mean, Rahm Emanuel said to Politico that Biden's top three agenda items were COVID relief, COVID relief, COVID relief. So, which he's accomplished, which is no small thing. And you might
let me just say, I am thankful for this. Donald Trump was omnipresent. He wasn't omniscient, but he was omnipresent. Thank goodness he wasn't omnipotent. I'm happy to not. And maybe it's just because I might have to stay up late and watch this thing. Okay, so I have some.
I mean, he's going to give the speech. It's just going to be, you know, it might not be until April, but it will happen.
But I think it's nice to take a little break. And by the way, he's giving a speech about Thursday night, I think, about the 1 year, you know, anniversary of COVID. I don't know how to describe it.
Right.
But it's not like he's disappeared. But I do like the lower. I like the lower profile. That makes me like Joe Biden more.
But here's the downside of that. In lieu of setting your agenda early, others might try to set it for you. You already have the House cranking out bills. They're all democratically drafted. They're not getting, you know, I don't think anyone's got more than five or so Republican votes. They're not expected to get Republican votes in the Senate. They're designed to juice the base and perhaps force a confrontation in the Senate in hopes of getting Manchin and Sinema to crack on the filibuster. And if that's what Biden wants, then, you know, then go for it. But if Biden wants to say, look, these are really my three things, I need to start managing expectations of what progressives in my party should be expecting in the next year or so, and not have them put all their energies into certain issues, which I think are dead ends. He's not doing that yet. And is April too late? Will expectations get, you know, unrestrained, uncontained? So when Biden tries to do it, it's a lot harder. And there'll be more disappointment, more hurt feelings, more internal division. That's the risk, I think, with what's happening right now.
Have I told you, Bill, how much I like this weird thing that Sinema and Manchin are my two favorite senators right now? It's a very bizarre thing. And those two are so different, but so cool. And I feel like Sinema is just doesn't care. She's got like it's such a cool quality. Does not care what people think. Just such an individualist. It's so cool. And
did you ever think your favorite senator would be a bisexual atheist?
I didn't. Like, if you had that on your bingo card, if you were betting at home, probably not. But you know, it goes back and forth between her and Manchin. But I wouldn't have bet on this. But I do hope that they stand firm, and it seems like they will. But there's going to be immense pressure on them to cave.
Well, you know, Manchin has gone on a little bit of a speaking tour. Opening the door to filibuster.
A little bit. He pulled a full, what's it called when you do
Did he do a full Ginsburg? I think
he did a four-fifth. Was it five? I think a Ginsburg is five.
You need all five for a Ginsburg.
I think he did four.
And so if folks don't remember, it's not a reference to Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It's a reference to Monica Lewinsky's lawyer who did all five shows when he was first brought on to her legal team. That is, so that's what's called a full Ginsburg. And
he did a 80% Ginsburg.
So he has been saying that he likes the idea of a talking filibuster where you're required to be on the floor and talk to have a filibuster. He's opened the door to an idea put forth by Norm Ornstein, who's at the American Enterprise Institute, who said you shouldn't need 60 to break a filibuster. You need to produce 41 to sustain a filibuster. So Manchin's said he's interested in that idea. And what he has not said yet and has not been asked about it, to my knowledge, and I wrote about this the monthly this week also, it's one thing to be for those reforms. It's another thing to say, I'm going to deploy the nuclear option to get those reforms. Because typically, to change the Senate rules, the cloture vote is not 60, it's 67. It's meant to have a high bar because you're changing the rules. Rule changing is not meant to be to that advantages one party over the other. But the nuclear option is the presiding officer essentially ignores the cloture rule, and then someone raises the point of order saying that the officer is out of line, and then you sustain the officer's ruling by a majority vote. That's the nuclear option. It's called that way because it effectively ends the filibuster. If you can change the rules and pass things on a majority vote all the time, then you don't have these supermajority thresholds anymore.
Is it something you could do once for a rule change and then not do again, or is there a slippery slope if you do it once?
I think there's inherent slippery slope. Once you do it, it is known that you can do it. So at the minute that the filibuster is in your way, the precedent has been set and people can reasonably say, hey, you could pass this big bill if you just did this thing that you agreed to do, you know, last year or the other party did last year. And so why aren't you doing it?
Well, we have done it, right? Harry Reid did it.
That's
Mitch
right.
McConnell did it.
So we've
done it on getting rid of the judicial filibuster.
That's
and
right.
Supreme Court.
So this is the question. You know, has the Pandora's box already been opened? This already has been done three times.
Okay, I know Harry Reid did it once to get rid of the judicial filibuster.
McConnell did it twice. There was a third time that was a little bit more obscure, but it still was related. It was related to expediting the judicial nominations.
But it hasn't happened legislatively.
Correct.
Okay.
So this is the question. Are we already in the slippery slope? Because it already has been done once. And once you do it once, you're never going to restrain it because everyone knows that you can do it. Or can you hold the line? Can Manchin sit him and say, look, we did it for judges. Now, mind you, Manchin's the only person to have voted against the nuclear option every time. And he's bragged about that fact. Can they hold the line and say, we're just not going to do this for legislative filibusters? It's going to permanently warp the character of the Senate, and I'm not going to let you. Is that finger in the dike? And once they leave the Senate, someone else is going to do it. Or will they crack? Will they say, look, well, I said I wouldn't get rid of the filibuster, but I can reform the filibuster in this way. That's different. I didn't say I wasn't going to do that. That's the hope that a lot of Democrats have right now. And I think it is probably well understood that if you reform the filibuster, it's talking filibuster, it's 41, not 60, or maybe you lower the threshold to 60 to 55. Once you change that rule by simple majority vote, the filibuster might as well not even be there. It maybe it doesn't go down on Manchin's watch, but he's not going to be in the Senate forever. It will go down once the nuclear option is deployed. So if you're Manchin, you might do this and say, I didn't flip-flop because I'm not getting rid of the filibuster. But in your heart of hearts, you know you kind of did. Now, maybe he'll do that. If he really means what he says, it says, my ultimate goal is to protect the filibuster at all costs, the reasonable decision is to not deploy the nuclear option. Because you run a massive risk of the slippery slope in that case. But yeah, I can't... largely predict is that the congressional Democrats are pushing a strategy to put maximum pressure on Manchin to reform the filibuster using the nuclear option. That is their goal at this point.
How come you started the DMC without me?
Because you're in school.
No, I'm not. It's Wednesday.
It's still school. You're supposed to be in school. I can't make a smoothie right now.
After?
Sure.
Hi. Bill Scher won't even make a smoothie.
What?
What did he say?
He said hi.
A liberal Bill Scher didn't even take time to make a smoothie.
I guess we don't even know where cinema stands. What cinema has said is, I want to restore a 60-vote threshold for all Senate business. So I don't know what that means in terms of, talking filibuster is... Once the talking stops, you can pass the bill with 50 or 51, depending on the VP. So if Sinema means what she says, talking filibuster wouldn't meet her standard.
Right. I got two quick questions for you, Bill, because I know you got to go make a smoothie. I want to talk about Blunt retiring and what that means.
Okay.
Hang on. What's up? So you mentioned what I would not have predicted, that I'd be such a stan for Sinema. She seems freaking cool. But what I want to know is why? Why is she all of a sudden this, like, admittedly kick-ass, irreverent, but centrist? Why is she? What happened that made her a centrist? Why did
she used to be Green Party for all things?
I know. What did we did not see this coming, did we?
I mean, I don't know if I would have suggested she'd be this much.
I'm a conservative,
of a centrist.
And like, she's much better than Martha McSally, like, just on so many levels.
Well. I don't think anyone can say exactly why. She's fairly inscrutable. She doesn't talk to the press a lot. And I think there are people who sort of understand Manchin. Okay, you're in a very Republican state, very Trumpy state. You got to do this to survive. Arizona's trending blue. You are winning with the votes of Native Americans and Latinos and white college-educated liberals who are migrating from California. You don't need to be doing this. Why are you doing this? And all I can conclude is she has a different analysis of the Arizona electorate than the average progressive does. That even though it's a changing electorate, it still has a pretty big moderate / maverick streak. John McCain, quintessential maverick. Although, of course, maybe Democrats thought McCain milked that too much and didn't deserve the title. But he clearly had the reputation.
Part of her
thing that being a maverick Democrat is the way to survive in Arizona.
Well, and the maverick thing, her image, her brand, she's like the Lady Gaga of the U.S. Senate. I mean, her brand is edgy and I mean, it's not traditional.
Right.
I mean, it's a cool brand, but her politics are not radical right now. I mean, it is gutsy, and it's flamboyant, but not radical.
And this drives the left in Arizona up the wall. They may well try to primary her. Someone cut an ad against her after she did the thumbs down on the minimum wage vote, a radio ad. Now, she's not up till 2024, so I don't know what use that ad's going to be. But certainly people are organizing to challenge her and thinking that she's ripe to be taken down. I don't know how left the Arizona Democratic electorate is, but that's a pretty hard thing. There hasn't been a successful ideological primary challenge of a Democratic incumbent senator, I don't know, ever. Certainly not in recent memory. So that's a pretty tall task. And
in a world where everyone falls in line and does what they're told and wears the same costume, it's refreshing to have someone really go to the beat of their own drummer.
And we'll see. I mean, clearly, the internal Democratic Party pressure on the two of them is going to get very, very hot over the course of the year. And you know, I think Manchin is fairly unpressionable. Republican state in his 70s, may not even run again.
He needs to hold on until the next generation of Lewises come of age. And then there's going to be two West Virginia Senate seats that ain't going to be, you know, they're not going to make it for 20 more years probably before they retire.
And so the question of Sinema is, does she think that she is not easily challengeable on the left, and that her long-term longevity requires owning the middle of Arizona? And if that's the case, she's going to be hard to pressure too. But I can't be mind readers. I can't know exactly what's in their head or what buttons can be pushed to flip them. But and mind you, even if they do flip on filibuster reform, that's not a given that you know opens the floodgates to a Democratic agenda. I mean, you can have the talking filibuster and have Ted Cruz say, "Hot damn, give me the green eggs and ham. I'm gonna talk on the floor for 2 months and you can't stop me." While a talking filibuster occurs, Democrats can't do anything else. They can't confirm a judge. They can't pass any other bill. The reason why we have silent filibusters is because there was so much filibustering by segregationists in the 60s, and the Democrats got sick of it and said, okay, we're going to create a two-tier structure where if a filibuster is going on, we can still do other business in part of the day and not be completely hogtied. That's when the stealth filibuster began around 1970. It's true that a minority has to really decide, are we doing this? Are we going to like call attention to ourselves to oppose seemingly popular legislation? Do we have the stamina to hold the floor for days and days on end? You know, you look at the American Rescue Plan vote and you say, hey, if they can hold tight on a bill that has 75% support because it appeals to their base, maybe they can. Maybe they can say, hey, this is great for fundraising. This is great for burnishing our individual brands at home. And if we can nominate judges because we're doing this, all the better. Maybe they crack. Maybe it allows for more legislation to get through than otherwise. I can't totally say. But it's not a given that if this happened this year, then bang, zoom, everything the Democrats want passes.
All right. Maybe we should end on this one. Another retirement, another establishment institutionalist, one might say, Republican retirement in the U.S. Senate. What do you make of this?
I mean, I think Republicans who don't want to be part of a Trump party, don't want to kiss the ring, and don't want to be on the sidelines in a Democratic majority Senate are saying, I got better things to do. And the question then is, do these retirements give Democrats any opportunities for pickups? Now, I think people think Democrats have a shot in Pennsylvania, have a shot in North Carolina. We have a bit less of a shot in Ohio, but not inconceivable. And now Missouri. Right. They might have shot Missouri, maybe not Missouri.
But the other thing, Bill, is regardless of whether Democrats are able to capitalize, this is probably good news for Trump, for the MAGA takeover of the Republican Party. You know, maybe you get Josh Mandel instead of Rob Portman. Maybe you get, is it Greitens, whatever.
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce it. The guy
instead
who
of Blunt.
Is accused of physically torturing a woman in his house.
Mistakes were made, Bill. But that could be your next U.S. senator from Missouri.
Yeah.
My point being, this, it's unclear whether this helps Democrats in terms of winning seats, but it very, I think it's more clear that it transforms, it gets rid of Republicans like Pat Toomey, who's a Republican, who's a conservative, but an institutionalist, a sane kind of establishment guy by now. he's always been sane, but I'd consider him an establishment guy now. He was once a insurgent. But it gets rid of people like Toomey. And whether they're replaced by a Democrat or a MAGA person is not the point. You're getting rid of normal Republicans and replacing some of them with Trump.
But whether that leads to more Democratic or Republican seats is relevant. Is a wholly MAGA-fied party going to be a permanent minority party because they're going to lose seats that they might otherwise get? Or is the polarization so deep in places like Ohio and North Carolina and Missouri that MAGA Republicans can still win in those states? I mean, Ohio is sort of an interesting question because Trump won the state twice, but their statewide officials in recent years have been John Kasich, Mike DeWine, and Rob Portman. So some people think, well, there's a bit of a lagging indicator and the MAGA people are coming. But we have a test case coming and we'll find out. In Missouri, Claire McCaskill hung on for as long as she did because Republicans kept putting up people who were too far to the right, and she managed to eke out narrow elections. In one case that she actively, meddled in the Republican primary and got the opponent that she wanted. We don't know if the Democrats will put up, a solid candidate that could do well against the far right candidate. And of course, the backdrop here is going to be, how well is Biden doing? How well are Democrats seen in the eyes of the median voter in these states where they say, you know what, if a moderate Democrat gets in there, I'm okay because they're doing stuff that I'm cool with. Or they're going to say, well, Democrats are really overreaching here. Who cares this Republican is kind of a Fruit Loop? I need to put a check on Biden.
If history's a predictor, then Biden will have a bad midterm. And I think it's also true that Democrats didn't do all that great in 2020, other than winning the, they
Senate.
Win the presidency. Let me do a plug for John Allen's book, I think appropriately titled Lucky. He's coming on the podcast, Matt Lewis in the News podcast. Probably only won the Senate because Donald Trump sabotaged Georgia. So it's not like they dominated.
But
so,
Donald Trump sabotaged Georgia. Can Donald Trump sabotage other states?
Do it again.
Well, here's another, I think, big X factor for 2022. And that is the pieces of the rescue plan that expire. So we have two things in the rescue plan that are hoped for on the Democrats' part to be more than just temporary relief measures. They're meant to be permanent changes, but currently are not. The biggest one is this child tax credit, which can be paid out monthly. You get advanced payments on the credit, and they effectively work like a monthly check for every child that you have. It's not quite the Andrew Yang universal basic income where like your entire income is, or like some piece of your income is covered, and you're getting, tens of thousands of dollars, every month or year. But It's something, you know, it's some check that you get every month and you might get accustomed to. And this is going to 93% of children in the country this year. There's also an augmentation of the Obamacare subsidies that are for the year. So what happens in...
Before we get to the whether people will get used to it or addicted to it, can I just talk for a second about the idea in general?
Sure.
Okay. So first of all, I stand to gain personally from this.
Mm-hmm.
You have to make a lot of money to not be eligible for this.
Yeah.
And I do think that, look, if we've, you know, it could be that the idea of being like fiscally conservative is over, right? The era of big government is here. Mm-hmm. Thanks to Donald Trump, partly. And if you're going to accept that premise, then the question is, what do we want to subsidize? What kind of behavior do we want to subsidize? And I think you could make a common good conservative argument. We ought to subsidize having kids and raising kids. And that would be a if government's going to put its thumb on the scale and incentivize something and subsidize it, then having kids and taking care of them and would be something that you could argue, I think, that is a conservative thing. The downside, if you put, I mean, the obvious concern is just spending, right? But if you put that aside, you know, there are concerns among some conservatives of there is no work requirement attached to this, right? And so there is like the danger of like a moral hazard of having people who have kids to get more money without working, and it disincentivizes getting getting married at some point, right? So you could have this moral hazard or these perverse incentives. So I think what we're seeing is on the right as it relates to this policy, which, you know, Mitt Romney is even been championing doing this. We're seeing a clash between kind of the 1990s Republican and welfare reform as we know it. It's a good idea. It's Bill Clinton's line. We're gonna, you know, end welfare reform, you know, but also the era of big government is over, right? That's kind of the clash, I guess. It goes back to the 90s.
Well, back in the 90s, you know, Republicans and conservatives have always been pretty eager to encourage having children, except if you're on welfare. I mean, that was the old push was to cap benefits tied to new kids. And say if you have one kid too many, then you don't get any more money for that kid. And to have the work requirements, you know, everyone should be stay at home moms unless you're poor. Then you should get out in the workforce and have put that extra strain on your child raising. So we haven't had these culture war style debates on this subject yet because this skated through in the larger relief plan. Once it becomes a standalone vote at the end of this year, whether to extend this permanently or not, are we going to kick up all of these older arguments? I mean, so there's the welfare argument, there's the spending argument. The Romney proposal. Romney had a proposal to do something like this, but he was going to cut other welfare spending with it. Whereas Biden and Democrats now added on to current spending. How will that fight go down? Who stands to lose in that fight? You know, I saw an argument from a Democratic strategist saying this is an easy one for Democrats. Republicans voted to give tax cuts to billionaires without any care about the deficit. But when it comes to your check, they want to take that away. That'll be the Democratic argument. Right. Now,
compelling argument, and Republicans are hypocrites, and but I'm still wrestling with like what actually is the best public policy. Mm-hmm. Because I on one hand, if we're going to be in the business of government picking winners and losers, then let's start rewarding people who are having kids and incentivize, you know, Bill, it's freaking expensive to have kids. Have you noticed?
Oh, yeah, I've noticed.
It is super expensive to have kids. And, you know, it I'm not an expert on this, but my understanding is that, like, our income has not kept pace with the cost of child rearing. It's just gotten progressively more expensive to be a parent. And if you care about family values and social conservatism, and if you believe, like I do, that if we want to compete with China, it might help to have some people in the country, that we're not having enough kids, this is an issue. But I also can identify with, like, the 1990s, you know, Bill Clinton era that said, like, there are unintended consequences that you could have, that we could have, you know, bad things come from a well-intended policy. And that, so, you know, I'm kind of torn on this. So there's the political concern, but what about the kind of policy issue?
For me?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have those conservative concerns. You know, I think in terms of, I mean, this is in many ways a kind of a wealth redistribution policy, and I think the right kind. Raising kids is hard, is expensive, and people are squeezed in the lower class, the middle class, pretty regularly on this score. And if you can ease that burden in a way that doesn't involve complicated government bureaucracy, that's just a simple payment, then that suits me just fine. Now, there is...
Well, I mean, so there's like a philosophical problem of government, you know, being our daddy, which I have a problem with. But what about the gaming of the system? I mean, like, are there examples of people who now have an incentive to keep having more kids, never get a job, and not get married?
I don't think this payment is so big. They're going to say, hey, I'm just going to have another kid for the heck of it. That's the whole welfare cap argument never really, you know, stuck with me, because it's, I mean, people might have kids that they have a hard time taking care of, but you're not going to do it. Oh, I got a new government program. Now I'm going to have a kid. Now it's easy. I mean, this isn't going to cover all of the costs for your child. So it's not like, I highly doubt this is going to, you know, cause some sort of, you know, baby boom.
Yeah.
You know, in the lower
there's
classes.
There's also, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is like a refundable tax credit, right?
Plus, so that,
this
that's, would what, be, that's why it helps the poor more, because you can pay net zero in taxes, federal taxes, and still get the benefit, still get the tax credit. Whereas Republicans are more likely to say if you're below zero, then you're not paying taxes, so you should be given the check because that's a welfare handout. But this will be refundable.
So you're saying we're not having this debate now, but this is coming because it's going to come up for renewal.
I mean, I can't exactly predict, you know, the contours of that debate. I'm sure there will be a debate because there have to be a vote. I don't think Republicans are going to say whatevs. They're going to say something about it. And here's the other wild card. Joe Manchin keeps saying that he's concerned about the national debt, that we've spent trillions and trillions and trillions. And we got to start tightening up. He wants the infrastructure bill to be 100% paid for with tax revenue. Is he prepared to, this I believe was cost at $100 billion a year. Is he prepared to keep this program as a permanent program without any offset? I just don't know the answer to that. But I wouldn't go in assuming Democrats have 50 in hand for a permanent extension of this. Because, I mean, if it's going to pass again, if it's going to become permanent, it's going to be reconciliation. It's not going to be a 60-vote bill for something that Republicans didn't vote for in the first place. And so to get that reconciliation, you need all 50. I don't know if Manchin or any other Democrat is going to have reservations about doing that on deficit-related concerns. Where are we with inflation a year from now? I mean, most people are saying the inflation argument is off the mark at the present time. And hey, I'm not an economist. You know, Goldman Sachs isn't worried. The Fed isn't worried. Maybe I shouldn't be worried. But we'll have numbers by December. If inflation is rising, that's going to bring the deficit skulls out of the woodwork. And that might complicate whether this gets extended or not. And if it's not extended, what does that do to Democratic unity for 2022?
This is a pretty good show, man.
Well, we should leave it here, especially since my battery is down to 6%.
That's probably a good sign to, yeah, to
properly. So you're plugging your podcast with Jonathan Allen, right?
Yeah, Jonathan Allen talking about his book, Lucky. I'm talking to the Utah governor, Spencer Cox, today.
Ask him about mail voting, because they do mail voting in Utah.
Ah, good idea. Remind me, I got to write that down. I'm also talking to a West Virginia reporter about the Mountain State, which is having a moment, not just because of Joe Manchin, but partly because of Joe Manchin. Also because of Jim Justice and masks and vaccines. And I talked to a children's book author named Lisa Britton about the war on boys. So check out Matt Lewis and the News on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. Amazon now, Bill. We're on Amazon, wherever you get your podcasts.
And I'll talk to you on Friday in the DM Zoom.
Yes.
Well, until then.
And you've got – check out Bill's columns in
– Yeah, I got two in the monthly so far this week. Hopefully some more coming before the week is out.
Awesome. All right. We'll see you on Friday in the DM Zoom and back here in the DMZ next week.
All right. Take care.